it's Jeremy here from the Front Row Network, and I just wanted to hop on here real quick to give you a quick little message before this episode. As you know, we are right now in the midst of our Oscar Spotlight series. The big ceremony is coming up on February 9th on a Sunday. And of course, before we even get to this episode, I want to encourage you, if you want to come and watch the Oscars with us, you can do that live with the Front Row at the Hoagland Center for the Arts. Go to hcfta.org, and you will find the Front Row hosts the Oscars, the second annual one, and you can come there, watch with us, and have a chance to win great, fabulous prizes, lightning round trivia on every single one. And of course, even if you can't be there with us, we will once again be doing our live reactions on every single commercial break with the Front Row personalities and some special guests. Now, what you're about to hear is our Oscar Spotlight, which is really our full disclosure on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Now, we did this full disclosure many, many months ago when the film first came out in the summer, but as we're trying to get all of the most nominated films, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is definitely one of those and one of the biggest contenders, we felt we would just re-release it here, give you a quick little message saying that it's now doubling as an Oscar Spotlight, and just in case you missed it, here it is. So, enjoy, join us now as they break down Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Hello out there in podcast land. My name is Phil Rockwell, and you are listening to Full Disclosure on the Front Row Network, the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood review. My name is Phil Rockwell. You may know me as the Pop Culture Draft Night host and the resident Front Row Network contrarian. With me tonight, I am joined by Brian Dressel, head of the ATH Podcast Network, host of After the Hype and Venture Brothers, a Venture Brothers podcast. Hello, Brian.
Yo.
And also joining us is a new but still prolific guest on the Front Row Network. She's participated in our bracket podcasts. She endured the 1994 Deep Dive podcast with me, and she endured the Guilty Pleasures Wild Wild West episode. Please welcome Erin McCabe.
Hello out in podcast land.
And we are, as I said, we are here to talk about Quentin Tarantino's 9th/8th film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Real quick, I'll give a just brief plot summary because we're going to go pretty in deep with this. In 1968, an over-the-hill action star and his stunt double try to reclaim former glory as the specter of real-life tragedy follows a vibrant young actress through some of her final days. I should say, if it's not obvious, spoiler warning, we're going to go through the nitty-gritty of this movie. So if you're on the fence about seeing it, you probably want to tap out and listen to this after you have seen the film. So I guess the best place to start, Quentin Tarantino is the only director I can think of where each film he adds to his oeuvre is taken as part of a whole with the rest of his films. We don't look at the new Steven Spielberg film and evaluate as a part of all of Steven Spielberg's films. But that always happens to occur with Tarantino. And unfortunately for him, that means there's a lot of baggage that comes with that. There seems to be more baggage than usual with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood because of what has happened since his last film. We had the Uma Thurman New York Times article where she spoke of a stunt that nearly killed her, where she was forced to drive a car against her wishes, ended up crashing it into a tree. Tarantino has made some questionable remarks about Harvey Weinstein, Roman Polanski. Obviously, he has criticism following him throughout his career for his films and his treatment of race, language around race, violence against women. And I think this film, more than any of his others, seems like a response to some of that criticism. But I guess where I want to start, I'll start with you, Brian. Where is Tarantino on your general sort of film radar? Are you a diehard? Are you, you know, do you detest him as a director, as I know some do? You know, what do you see? What do you see as far as Quentin Tarantino goes?
I would say I used to be a diehard fan, probably in college-ish, where I think every dude who went to film school was a diehard fan, at least for a little period of time.
Sure.
And I also loved him in high school. I mean, I remember my parents bringing home a VHS copy of Reservoir Dogs to watch, and I had to go to bed. Like, I remember, like, he's been in my life forever. So I still really enjoy him. And I think where I come from with Tarantino is that if he has a movie in theaters, be it one he produced, one that he directed or guest directed, I'm seeing it. I don't know if I'm going to like it or hate it or whatever, but either way, he's got my $15 every time, no matter what.
Yeah. He's not a director that you can just dismiss. I'll catch it whenever. I think part of that is the scarcity of his films. He takes his time going from film to film. And I guess the only one I would compare him to is when Eyes Wide Shut came out, Stanley Kubrick's last film. That's what it felt like. You know, he hadn't put out another film since, I think that was Full Metal Jacket was the one before that. But it was like 10 years. And it was an event for people who love film, and Tarantino's films still seemed to carry that. Aaron, I was worried about you going into this film.
I know.
But what feelings did you carry into Once Upon a Time in Hollywood as far as Tarantino goes?
So, what Phil is referring to is we're watching the Amazon Prime series, The Boys. And as I've grown older and more sensitive, I've realized as a mother and just in general, I've become better at recognizing that certain forms of violence are just a little too much for me, and having that boundary with myself to cut myself off. So Phil was kind of helping me navigate if that was a series I was going to continue to watch, which is kind of conflicting for me as well, because like I'm a person who really enjoys sci-fi. I grew up on 80s and 90s action movies. And you know, I've definitely read my fair share of graphic novels. So, going into this movie, knowing it was a Tarantino movie, I knew that there was going to be some level of violence, because that's kind of what his movies are known for, amongst other things. But so my history with him is, you know, I was only 10 when Reservoir Dogs came out, so I definitely did not watch that when it came out. I didn't see Pulp Fiction until I was a little bit older, but watched it nonetheless. I feel like my first like real conscious Tarantino movie was probably Kill Bill Volume 1 and 2. That was when I was in college. And then I enjoyed Death Proof. Death Proof is part of his Grindhouse with Rodriguez. So Django Unchained, like I've seen all those. So I was just, for me, I think the other part of Tarantino movies, on top of, I guess, because my background's not in film, is who he brings into his casts. You know, part of going to see him in the theater is knowing that you're going to have such an incredible cast and people who play well against each other, actors and actresses that are accomplished and craftsmen. And so, you know, the lure for me to go see this movie particularly was, I wanted to see the dynamic between Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio.
Sure.
And I didn't know a whole bunch. I didn't know a whole lot more about this movie. I didn't know that, I didn't know Sharon Tate, and that story was going to be intermingled in this. And I don't know, I don't have a huge frame of reference for the 1960s as far as film goes. So a lot of that was kind of days leading up to going to the movie was like, oh, I actually wasn't as, I didn't do a lot of research on this movie before I went to go see it.
Yeah. I think, as someone for myself who doesn't have a real, as strong a cultural understanding of that era as certainly as Tarantino does, he still does an incredible job of putting you in that era, and just having you feel it. It's so dense with, you know, radio, television, mm-hmm. there's just media throughout that entire, movie that gives you a sense of place and time. For me, I always really enjoy Tarantino's movies, but if you asked me just off the cuff, like, who are your top five directors, Tarantino's name wouldn't come up, mm-hmm. which, I mean, to me, it's interesting because, you know, I think Inglourious Basterds is great. I think Jackie Brown is amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, I would never call one of his movies bad. There are some I like less than others, but I don't know if, I don't know. He just never is part of that conversation for me, despite how much I end up enjoying his films when they come out.
Can I take a stab at why?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
My guess is, cause I've actually kind of had the exact same opinion. I love Tarantino. I like his movies. He's never in my top directors. And I think it's because whenever you watch a Tarantino movie, that's what you're watching. So he's never going to make like this grand swatch of just like different things. He's always making a Tarantino movie. And even this one, which feels distinctly different, I think, than the majority of his films, still had an undeniable Tarantino bend to it. So, like, no matter what, it's always one of his movies. So it's like, it'd be tough to say he's one of the best or one of the best ever or anything like that, or even one of your favorites, because there is a little bit of lack of, I don't really know how to.
His style is so specific.
It's so
and
specific.
His interests are so specific.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
So, like, even when you're watching, like, his most original film, it's still part of his style to kind of, like, crib from other movies and kind of pull from other things. I don't ever take that as ripping off, which a lot of people do. I always take it as like paying homage to. These are things that he loves and it's clear that he loves it. But because of that, it just kind of, it keeps you a little bit at arm's length, I think, the whole time from ever going, that is one of the best ever, because it's always Tarantino. Like, he is part of every one of his movies.
Yeah. And I think we're all pretty close to the same age. And I think there's something to the fact that, Pulp Fiction came out either when I was a freshman or a sophomore in high school. And at that point I was disliking things just because people were so hyped about them. And Tarantino is the type of cat that can rub you wrong very, very easily. And he is unable to escape his persona when his films come out. And I think there are plenty of people, including members of the Front Row Network, who just, they don't want to deal with his films because they dislike him so intensely, just on a personal level.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess I get that. I mean, I'm sure there are people like that I feel the same way. I can't think of one off the top of my head, but that's not completely unheard of. Like, when I was trying to find people for the Tarantino battle that we did at After the Hype, it was kind of tough, because even the guy we ended up having on, Matt Dykes, even he didn't really like Tarantino. He's like, I don't really watch his movies. They don't they don't work well for me. So he picked the one he liked the best.
Well, I found a line from Walter Chaw, who is he is the guy I adopted after Roger Ebert passed as like my critical guru. And he wrote what I think is the best line I've read about this film in terms of Tarantino's entire arc. He wrote, "It's his kindest film, the one freest of his ego and the defensiveness of showy camera work and clever editing. It's unpretentious in a wholly surprising way and vulnerable too, in revealing fears of growing older and, as a consequence, becoming obsolete, soft, a joke. Mm-hmm. And that the kindest film, especially, is what struck me. When I walked out of the theater, the word luxuriate was stuck in my head, because up until the final act, like, it was just, I just wanted to sit in this film and just be a part of the environment and the aesthetic and, you know, the time period. It was mm-hmm. just such a comfortable, almost warm film. And that is certainly not the descriptor you would expect for a Tarantino joint.
No, it actually felt really, it felt so un-Tarantino. Mm-hmm. And so I think walking in there, not knowing if the trailers had just not, like, if they had left out the Tarantino-ness of mm-hmm. it. Like, I walked in there with my husband thinking, well, yeah, it's a Tarantino movie, so you kind of have an idea of, like, what you're going to expect. There's going to be some violence. There's going to be witty dialogue. There's going to be some element of genre or exploitation, you know, film homage. There's going to be feet. Like, you know, all these things that's going to happen. And
he didn't disappoint on the feet.
He did not disappoint on the feet.
I went a little, like, too far in the feet, to be honest.
there were definitely, there were some long camera pauses on the feet, but she does have very cute feet. But anyway, we walked out of the movie and always my husband will always go, what did you think? And I literally was like, at first, when we first left the film, I was like, I didn't even know what to say, because I was like, that was so drastically different than what I expected. And he was like, I didn't like it. Like, I thought it was going to be a Tarantino movie, and it just wasn't. So it wasn't the pace he was looking for. He was expecting from him, you know, all those elements that he's carved for himself in these movies. It was just, it was really different, and in a good way. But it took me some days to, like, to think more about it and ruminate about it and really ponder it all. But it was like a nice leisurely pace for the first two acts.
I actually kind of disagree with both the Walter Charles and what your husband said of this not being a Tarantino movie. Like, I think this is incredibly a Tarantino movie. Mm-hmm. And it's more of Tarantino talking about himself.
Mm. Which,
like, sorry, go ahead.
I mean, has he done that much?
No.
I mean, he is very, this is going to be such a semantic sort of thing, but I know exactly what you're saying.
Right.
He's commenting about himself rather than showing us what he likes and what he's into and what he's interested to. When you're talking about your favorites or representing your favorites in a film that you're making, it's sort of, it's exterior commentary. This film feels like it's an interior look at himself and where he is in his life. And that is distinctly different. So you're right in that it's very Tarantino, but it's coming from an angle that we haven't ever seen from him.
It's Tarantino telling a story that he doesn't normally tell, but still telling it in his own way. Like, he doesn't tell the stories of, like, fear, of just fear in general is not usually in his wheelhouse. Usually danger is just kind of not there until you're dead and nobody cares. And this one, danger is a really real element throughout the whole movie. And the danger of growing old, of losing your job, of getting murdered, like, it's all there. And, like, that fear is really real. And I think this is Tarantino's take on that. So that's why it still felt like Tarantino to me throughout the whole thing, while not necessarily being like every one of his movies, it still was 100% him.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So one of the things that I was thinking about, was about American mythology. Mm-hmm. Because this movie takes an era that has its own mythology, and it takes three specific people that have their own mythologies and sort of reframes them. So you have Sharon Tate, you have Charles Manson and his flock, and then you have Bruce Lee. So I guess I'll just start with Sharon Tate. to me, Sharon Tate was never more than a victim until I saw this movie.
Yeah.
Now she feels like a human being mm-hmm. to me.
Yeah. He did a really great job. And that was one of the things I noticed. And like I said, sometimes I end up, when I walk out of a movie, not having all my feelings and thoughts put together. And then I spend a couple days and like things start to come to me. And that was definitely one of it that he really, with her, I felt like there was a really beautiful juxtaposition of the decline and the falling star of Rick Dalton. And at the same time, you're watching the hopeful, innocent rise of this new star and putting, yeah, humanness and a personality and everything on Sharon Tate instead of just the woman who got murdered by the Manson family.
Yeah.
It was so palpable.
When I first started living in LA, I had to work an internship where we were doing a haunted LA movie that never actually came to be. But because of that, I had to look up all the famous murders in LA, and I had to spend a lot of time on the Sharon Tate one. Mm-hmm. So because of that, I had a very different perception, I think, than a lot of people did, because I had to spend so much time looking into her as a person, what she was doing there, how pregnant was she, like all the crazy stuff. And I think because of that, I was actually left a little disappointed at the take of her in this movie because she is like, the whole movie is essentially a fairy tale. Like, it is very clear, a fairy tale, even in the title. So I was expecting more of like a fairy tale character from her. And it felt more like, and this is probably more harsh in the movie than I intended to be, but it felt like he was afraid to do too much with her.
Which is really ironic for Tarantino.
I think Margot Robbie's great throughout the whole movie, but she really doesn't have a lot to do.
Right.
Well, she has very few lines, and any lines she does are very soft.
Yeah, I think she's. I think she is a symbol.
Yeah.
Almost more than she is a character. I mean, I give, you know, he's able to sketch these traits into her. You know, she picks up a hitchhiker, and then when she lets her out, she runs around and gives her a hug. You know, these little, you know, she goes into the bookstore. The fact that she goes into the movie and is kind of naive and like, hey, if I'm in this, can I come in for free? And
yeah, a little insecure.
Yeah. And even the moment at the very end where she hugs Rick Dalton, just in this completely, just open, genuine way. It was like she was this ray of sunshine for Tarantino that he couldn't bring himself to extinguish in his film. And I'm going to be perfectly honest. I read the spoilers for the end of the film before I went and saw it, because I didn't know if he hadn't diverted from history. I don't know if I could have handled the scene, what actually played out.
Yeah.
On screen, especially knowing how Tarantino can stage, can stage something like that.
I didn't look up the spoiler, but I have to be honest. I totally saw it coming. Like, I went into the movie not expecting to see. Yeah, because he's done it in the past, not three movies, but two movies before Hateful Eight. He changes history all the time. Like, he does it so it ends better. Like, I kind of like that about him. Like, I like that he's like, hey, what if things weren't always shitty?
Mm-hmm.
And like this one, especially with like how you put it, I really like how you put it when she was a symbol. Like, she was this ray of sunshine. Like, I like that. And like, he lets her continue to shine. Because a lot of people credit her death with being like the death of joy in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't even know, to your point, Phil, I don't know that he couldn't bring himself to kill her. Or to let her suffer the end that she did in this reality. I felt it was more, now I'll say leading up to it, I didn't read any spoilers. I figured someone would have warned me, but I, but at the same time, like I obviously knew that she died. And I had heard about the Manson because obviously people were talking about that and there was fervor and, annoyance that he could possibly, glorify this case and everything like that. So I went into it. And I was under the impression that it was going to happen. I didn't know. For some reason, my mind was blanking on Inglourious Basterds and his affinity for alt history. But I was just like, okay, like, obviously he's threading this throughout. And it wasn't until I had completely forgotten that she was pregnant. So when they showed her pregnant and it still was not revealed that there was going to be an alternate ending, I was like, so I was sweating. Like I started getting panicky. Like I was like, I can't watch this. I can't do this. Like I had to leave, like, just, you know, full disclosure. Like I had to leave the theater in the Green Mile when the electrocution went wrong. Like I can't. So I was like, I was all prepared to like walk out of the theater and just be like, I can't do it. But I don't think he couldn't. I have a different perspective on the ending, and I don't know when, you know, you want to get into that. I'm happy to save it for later in the show. But I didn't think like, oh, I can't do it because she's this lamb. It's almost, he's got a, I feel he's Quentin Tarantino, for as much as people say he's misogynistic and he's a woman hater, I actually think that in many of his films, he's got, you know, female characters that he allows in their story to be vindicated in the end. And so what this actually felt like more to me was Sharon Tate being vindicated.
Well, we'll get to the final third.
Yeah. Sorry. I don't.
No. That's perfectly fine. Before we get there, though, I want to talk about Manson, who gets, mm-hmm. what, 20 seconds of screen time?
Yes.
He shows up at the Tate-Polanski mansion, just sort of skulking about. He's chased off by, that was Cliff, right?
No, that was Rick.
It was Rick? Okay, so yeah. He gets chased off by
Cliff. Like drunk in a bathrobe screaming at him.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's when Cliff was out getting high on acid.
Oh, right. Wait, are you talking about when Manson shows up and the photographer is there, like, in the, you're talking about in, like, the second act, right? Like, where he walks by and goes, oh, does Terry live here?
Where we actually see Manson himself.
Yeah.
I was thinking the end of the movie. Sorry, my bad.
No, that's all right. The thing, so Charles Manson is probably the American boogeyman.
Yeah.
I can see that, yeah.
Just this spooky, mysterious, you know, crazy guy who perpetrated these murders, which it's he never murdered anyone that we know of. That's not why he was in jail.
No, he got everyone else to do it.
He got everyone to do it for him.
Yeah.
Which is terrifying. He still had this mystique about him. And whereas Tarantino seemed to elevate Sharon Tate, I think he did the opposite with Charles Manson, mm-hmm. and the Spawn Ranch crew by making them just seem like these, for lack of a better word, dirty hippies, mm-hmm. living out in the desert,
mm-hmm.
doing, you know, whatever. It's a bunch of kids essentially who came out to Hollywood and went out into the desert and got high.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're living in a house with a blind man who actually owns the place, giving tours to on horseback. I mean, it's just this ugly sort of ramshackle operation that ended up having this enormous effect on the American psyche. And it looked like Tarantino was doing everything he could to diminish that, to sort of break the spell.
Yeah, and I think he did a really interesting thing where he only showed Charles Manson for, right, 20 seconds. It was it had that eerie kind of Halloween feel to it.
Yeah.
Like, you didn't need a whole lot to just kind of have your skin crawl. But he wove in the Manson family, like, in Hollywood and kind of in that background with Cliff.
Yeah,
you
feel them throughout the entire film, even when they're not there.
Yeah, and it created such a creepy and eerie element that I really actually appreciated he did that, because it just felt like, yeah, there was nothing glorifying about it. It was definitely like, yeah, and the fact that even when they showed the Spawn Ranch and even when they showed all the girls and everything else like that, like, how under his control they still were, and he was never present.
Mm-hmm.
That felt intentional.
I think it was intentional, and I think it worked really well to make that entire camp just seem horrifying.
Mm-hmm.
And my favorite thing about it, and I think I was going to mention it earlier and I kind of forgot, but the thing about this movie is that it really plays on your expectations of Tarantino.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, the whole movie you're like, well, this is going to happen because it's a Tarantino movie. Mm-hmm. And then you think he's going right, he goes left almost every time. And specifically for me, the one that I liked the most was actually at that camp. Because the whole time that they're there, I'm like, well, I guess Brad Pitt's about to die. Like, I'm just like, well, I really like this character, but this feels like a Tarantino setup for him to get killed. For sure.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then every time it's like, well, this is it. And it's like, it even has like that drowning bass noise to it where like you have that like feeling of dread. And then all of a sudden, oh no, it's him. He's just blind. He was napping. Exactly like Dakota Fanning said. Like, why were you overreacting? Everything's fine.
Mm-hmm.
It did such a good job just keeping on your toes of like, what's going to happen? Nothing. What's going to happen? Still nothing. Stop freaking out. It's cool, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what I found interesting at the end of that is you're expecting violence throughout that entire scene.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of it, the person who ends up being responsible for the violence is Cliff.
Mm-hmm.
Which it shocked me when it happened, because it just, there had been nothing like that sort of aggressiveness throughout the entire film. And then he just lays waste to this dirty hippie who knifed all his tires.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get to Cliff, because Cliff is the character I've been thinking about for 2 weeks since I saw this movie.
Say, Cliff is the reason I love this movie and don't just kind of like it.
Yeah.
He's
a complicated cat. Mm-hmm. But real quick, I did want Bruce Lee, the performance or the appearance of Bruce Lee is probably the most controversial thing in the film. Bruce
Lee's
family. Yeah,
people they're real outraged by this.
Right,
what I
Bruce
understand.
Lee's family hates it.
Mm.
I won't lead into this one. I'm going to throw Brian under the bus. How did you feel about the Bruce Lee scene?
Should I mention my connection to the actor? Because it's kind of weird.
Mike Moe?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
He's neighbors with my sister. In fucking Madison, Wisconsin. Go figure.
Oh, that's rad. So funny.
That's rad.
Apparently, that's not even Madison. It's a suburb of Madison. I'm being nice to everybody who lives there. But yeah, apparently the town is really, really happy for him. And it's like, ooh, they were really happy for you, and now you're just all over the controversy.
Yeah, well, I think okay.
Here's my take on it.
Yeah.
And I hope this doesn't just completely make everybody out there hate me. I went into the movie assuming a fairy tale. So I didn't take anything at face value. I don't take this as a legitimate interpretation of Manson or Sharon Tate or the fictional characters. I think everybody on screen is fiction because they've told me essentially that it's a fairy tale. So if this is the fairy tale's version of Bruce Lee, then so be it. So when Tarantino had his reaction, I think last week or earlier this week, where he's like, everyone's telling me Cliff couldn't beat him. Well, Cliff is a fake character, and I made him, so I say he can beat him. I don't really have issue with that argument. And I don't know Bruce Lee. I've seen his movies. I think he's an awesome dude. And I think it's really cool that like so many people attach themselves so much. But yeah, it's annoying that they made him out to be an asshole. But Tarantino does a twist on everyone.
Yeah. I'm gonna shout out Walter Chaw again because he's a Chinese American film critic who wrote an article called "Why Are We Laughing at Bruce Lee?" And he is sort of an outlier. That the only person I've seen of sort of Asian ancestry who felt like the fact that they made Bruce Lee seem like less than a god and an icon did a service to him. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the mystique of Bruce Lee has been built up so much. And you can kind of see it from the objections of the family. I mean, you don't want to think that, you know, Bruce Lee was cocky and you know, talked too much. But he kind of was. He had to be as a minority in 1960s television.
Well, it's that. And then my other thing is, who else has, like, yeah, he can back it all up. If he's cocky, yeah, good for him. He fucking earned it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it didn't mean he was a jerk. Awesome. Right.
Yeah, I mean.
Yes, where I eventually come to is I wish it was done differently, but it doesn't bother me probably as much as it should. And maybe that's on me and I have to do some self-reflection and see why this is such a problem. But when I watched it, it didn't bother me, and I expected it to because I saw it after the whole controversy kind of flared up. So I'm going into it like almost gritting my teeth. Like I was worried more about this scene than I was the Sharon Tate part because I assumed that wasn't going to happen. So the whole time I'm sitting down, I'm like, God, that Bruce Lee scene is coming, and I don't know what I'm going to feel about it. And then it happened, and I'm like, yeah, we probably shouldn't be laughing at it. I didn't really laugh at all. I just thought that was the scene, and then it was over.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't if I laughed it was out of joy. Like I just found it to be a fun scene and Mike Mo just
he was so
absolutely
good.
Destroyed that part that it's like there's so much good there. I'm not going to begrudge anyone having objections to it. Obviously, we all come from different places, and you know this is a white guy talking. But it's one of the scenes that I think makes the film so rich in that there are a lot of different ways to look at it and interpret it, and I will listen to anyone's sort of discussion of this. And the scene itself brings me to my big question about the film. And you said that Cliff Booth is the reason you love this movie.
Oh yeah.
So let me ask you this: did he kill his wife?
I don't think so. No.
Okay.
I think it's a rumor that got out of hand. Now I realized that with that flashback scene. It makes it pretty clear that I'm most likely wrong. And maybe it's just me going full ostrich and go like, no, I really like Cliff. I don't want him to go away. But at the same time, I just didn't believe it because we don't really ever get that much like legitimate backstory about him. And we're never really given, I don't know how else to describe it. It's just like, I watched it and I'm going, I don't think he did it. I think he thought about it. I definitely think he thought about it. But I didn't see that guy doing it. Like maybe it's just because it's Brad Pitt in the role, and maybe he just didn't lose himself enough in the role, and there's still just that much Brad Pitt and not enough Cliff that I'm like, well, I don't think Brad Pitt would kill his wife. So maybe it was that, and I just need to get over that. But I honestly thought the way they portrayed him, he was not somebody who'd murder his wife, from what I got from the movie.
Right. This, I mean, my second viewing is going to be like dissecting this question. But
yes,
Aaron, what did you feel about it?
I'd say my gut would say no.
Okay.
My gut would say no for the same reasons Brian did, in the sense that, and whether this was just really well played, his character otherwise was incongruent with some like. with murder. Mm-hmm. He was just so cool as a cucumber. He was always composed, seemed to really like enjoy everything. They never showed any indication that he could just snap.
Right.
Which and so that's why, yeah. And it, I don't know if that was a theme. I write the whole thing's a fairy tale and they're talking about, you know, different stories and everything like that. Like, and again, not knowing enough about the 1960s, like when information, like we don't have the plethora of information that you do now. Like, is it kind of like the Bruce Lee thing
mm-hmm.
where it's like, can a myth or can the mythology of a person grow so big into something that's completely unrecognizable from how they really are?
Right. Yeah, they did mention that. See, I have my inkling is that when I watch it the second time, I'm going to feel like he did. Because the acts of violence in this movie are all perpetrated by him.
That's an excellent point.
They mentioned that he was a Green Beret.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel what Brian is saying where I enjoyed watching Brad Pitt just movie star the shit out of this part.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't remember the last time that he was just full on. I'm just going to be charismatic as hell. Maybe like the Ocean movies, I guess. But one of the things that I've always, one of the reasons why I've always found Brad Pitt interesting, one of my favorite movies is Moneyball.
Yeah.
And Moneyball is a movie where Brad Pitt's swagger
yeah.
masks a huge chip on his shoulder.
That's
and I don't necessarily
point.
Think that's the same as Cliff Booth. I don't think Cliff Booth has a chip on his shoulder, but there's an edge underneath him. Just by the way Brad Pitt performs it, that I have a feeling the second time I watch it, I'm going to feel more like the first time I just don't want to believe it. And then the second time, you know, I may feel more like there's more evidence there than maybe I wanted to admit.
I totally see where you're coming from, and I really hope you're wrong.
Well, fortunately, cognitive dissonance can kick in, and we'll just choose to believe what we want to believe.
But the thing is that even if he did do it, and I'm not obviously not defending murdering your wife because that's bad. Don't do that. But there is something to be said about every Tarantino main character. I could pretty much guarantee I'd have to look around a little bit, but I think they're all horrible people.
Sure.
Like that's kind of his shtick is he makes mm-hmm. you like horrible people. So mm-hmm. if he didn't do it, then this is extremely out of character for Tarantino because he's just a good guy who has a bad reputation.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, you're probably right.
You know what though? It's interesting you say that because when I think about the movie and like, I think that Rick Dalton is the dick. Like he, and I loved his character too, but like he was kind of the jerk. Like Cliff does the heavy lifting for everybody, and gets taken advantage of a lot. And is kind of like, it's okay, buddy. Like with, you know, and really lets a lot roll off his back
mm-hmm.
and never instigates the violence. All of the violence is caused by him. But I may be wrong. I think the only time he actually is the one who starts it is with Clem, the dirty male hippie at the Spawn Ranch.
But even that had – he was responding to a situation.
Yeah, so that's my point. Like all the violence happens at his hands. He doesn't instigate any of it, like, or he doesn't start it. But like for me watching it, I thought that – like, it was like, I really liked Rick Dalton, but he was kind of a clueless pud.
But I don't think that made him a bad person. He was just kind of an idiot. And like
he was sad.
Yeah.
He was sad. Yeah. I didn't think he was evil, but I guess like it was just to your point that, I mean, he wasn't like the best, like he was kind of a crappy friend.
Oh, for sure.
To, you know, and like that kind of thing. But yeah, he wasn't awful. It just out of the two, from the lens I was seeing it through, Cliff seemed to be kind of taking the brunt of everything over Rick. I don't know.
Yeah, let's talk about Rick real quick, because I don't want to. He's the least fascinating part of this film to me.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean he's not great. I'm not the biggest Leonardo DiCaprio fan, mainly just because, probably because of The Revenant. I think anyone who voted for him to get best actor for freezing his ass off and eating like buffalo liver or whatever it was should be ashamed of themselves, because what he does in this film is magical.
He's so
his
good.
His scene in the trailer where he just berates himself.
So good.
For having, what, 8 whiskey sours or whatever was some of the funniest stuff that I have seen. And you got to appreciate this. I mean, he's probably the last real movie star we have. You know, the guy who's dating models and out on yachts and stuff like that. And he just up and down shows his ass in this film. Like, he is pathetic from frame one and just keeps going lower and lower.
Yeah.
And it's a joy to watch DiCaprio just kill that performance.
See, I'm a big fan of DiCaprio. Like, I will watch anything with him in it. I don't disagree with you on The Revenant. I think you're right on the money there. Even though I thought he was good in it, I don't think he deserved a statue for it. Right. But I think I could make a solid argument that this might be his best performance. And I think that mostly because of that sad nature we keep talking about. Because he keeps playing these characters that are just badasses and villains and horrifying. And then he gets off camera and he's got a bit of a stutter and he's always a little unsure of himself and he doesn't think anybody likes him. And then he goes on camera and he's the biggest person in the room and he's awesome. And then he gets off camera. He's like, could you stay and watch a TV show with me tonight, maybe? And it's like that ping-ponging back and forth between actor him and then real person him, I thought was just fantastic. Like, I could really, really sink my teeth into it. And it's interesting you said that he's the least fascinating part of the movie, because I agree with you on the first watch. But I'm guessing every watch after this, he's going to slowly but surely turn into my favorite character.
Oh, I think from a performance perspective, he's the most fun to watch.
Oh yeah.
He's just one that, I mean, he's pretty transparent because he wears everything on his sleeve. So I'm not really wondering about his motivations or, or, you know, these mystery boxes that Tarantino set up, like Cliff Booth's wife. But I mean, when you think about it, the middle third of what is essentially a pretty close to a 3-hour film is us just watching him work on the set and going from complete professional to complete breakdown to he gets that scene at the end where he just chews into this villain character. He hyped himself up and came out like a different person, and you're just riveted because it's like, oh, he's nailing it. He's not sputtering and stuttering and calling for lines. He is fully present. And it's this nice, it's really the one victorious moment he gets. If you take out it, depending on your interpretation of the final third of the movie. But gosh, yeah, it's so fun to watch, and it never feels like, I mean, those are long scenes with long takes, and it never feels like it.
Just a really brief side note. I've heard a lot of people complain about the length. I didn't notice it at all. When I was sitting there, I was engrossed beginning to end, and I was never like, when is this thing over? Like, when it ended, I'm like, oh, okay, so that was like, what, 3 hours? I had no idea.
Endgame felt three times as long
yeah.
as this movie did.
Absolutely.
And maybe it's because, like I said, I was just wanted to luxuriate in the time period and these movie stars giving killer performances and Tarantino clearly being introspective in one of his films and just, yeah, I just want to drink this film in. So let's get to the third act. And Aaron, I'm going to put you in the hot seat this time because the Tarantino has one of his one of the criticisms that is always levied at him is violence against women in his films.
Mm-hmm.
The final act involves violence against women, violence against two women who we know from history are stone cold killers.
Mm-hmm.
How did the very graphic violence of that final scene hit you as you were watching it?
So I will just go on record and say that my opinion of Quentin Tarantino is not that he is a misogynist. I think to say that he hates women is...
I don't agree with that either.
Yeah, I don't agree with that. If anything, what I've seen in his films is I think he's a pretty... I think he's pretty equal opportunity at whoever, you know, gets to be a hero, who gets to be a villain,
mm-hmm.
who gets violence directed at them. You know, I know that that's come into question and sometimes though and this is just my humble opinion, I think that when things get brought up and now that there are, you know, there's a lot more coming to the surface as far as women's treatment in Hollywood, I think sometimes people start to, and I know he's said things that have not necessarily helped his case or sure. have, you know, he's given apologies and he's been reflective of his lack of, his lack of tact or his, you know, he's lamented, I should have done more. I knew mm-hmm. and I didn't. And I actually find that, to be honest, instead of saying, hey, I knew nothing. Mm-hmm. I take that as what he said and saying like, you know, without falling on his own sword, like, yeah, I should have done more. We need to do more and moving forward that way. I don't think he hates women. So for the end of the movie, not knowing what to expect, like I said, I started getting really anxious and panicky and like mm-hmm. shuffling around in my seat, like planning my exit. We were in seats that were close to the door. I'm like, I can't do it. And then the scene happens where they decide to break into, you know, the fork in the historical road. They decide to break into Rick Dalton's house instead. And they decide to go do, the devil's business there, and they run into Cliff Booth. And so I am never a huge fan. The violence itself got uncomfortable because it became so graphic.
Yeah.
Like I did have to put my head down
mm-hmm.
to not watch it. But I want to say that as a woman, as a mother, knowing the history of what happened to Sharon Tate, knowing what these people did, it wasn't because it was a woman that the violence mm-hmm. was happening to. It could have been anybody. I personally don't need to see anyone's face get smashed in on a fireplace. That's just me. But because it happened to them, I know some people were like, oh my gosh, look at the end of the movie, like this violence was done to these women. It's like, I'm sorry, but contextually, these were two women and a man who intentionally and deliberately entered the home of somebody to either cause great bodily harm, dismember, or murder them.
Mm-hmm.
And that they did that in real life. And so the mother in me, like especially knowing when Sharon Tate died, she pleaded to them to let her live for another 2 weeks so that she could give birth to her son and then they could kill her.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, admitting my shadow side in saying that I didn't have a whole lot of remorse for what happened to those three on screen.
Right.
Outside of the fact, in fact, like I said, I thought this was Tarantino somehow vindicating Sharon Tate.
Mm-hmm.
But outside of the fact that, yes, the violence in and of itself, I wasn't like appalled that happened to a woman. I just was like, this is too much for me. It's not my thing. I'm going to put my head down until you know, it's that scene's over. And then I picked my head back up and went back on. So it didn't like scar me or anything. I was like, okay.
Yeah, it is graphic in a way that I don't, that is different from the way violence is portrayed in a lot of his other movies. Like I think about, you know, the guy who gets shot in the backseat of the car in Pulp Fiction is sort of a funny, goofy moment, as macabre as that is.
Mm-hmm.
Kill Bill, the violence is so operatic and over the top that it can barely be qualified as gore because it's just so silly.
Right.
So the thing starts with him hitting a woman in the face with a can of dog food?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was holding the dog food.
And that's funny. It was funny the way it happened. And then as the scene went on, I got more and more uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Not because, you know, I'm squeamish or anything, but because I think that was Tarantino's intent. He didn't want this to be a sort of jolly occasion. I think he intended for us to go, whoa, this is getting out of hand. When the dog goes after the woman on the ground, that's as upsetting a bit of violence as I've seen in many films. I did want to mention, you mentioned that you don't think Tarantino is a misogynist. I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
I do think he is an equal opportunity person in terms of violence on screen.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think he has a blind spot for the tone of some of his violence against women.
Mm-hmm.
This film, I don't think had that. The closest he gets is when the woman in the pool, when Rick goes and gets his flamethrower, which that is a little overkill, but I think the tone felt different in that scene than any of Tarantino's previous works like that. I think of like when Hitler was killed in Inglourious Basterds. It's almost gleeful. I mean, it's just as graphic and gross. But there's a sort of underlying go get 'em attitude to it. That,
well,
can I ask a question? What was your theater like during that scene? Because mine, I took a totally different way on this whole scene than both of you did.
There were not a lot of people in my theater.
Okay, I was in a sold out theater, and people were scream laughing at this sequence.
Really?
Like, men, women, everybody. They were, like, jumping up for joy at the whole sequence. Like, maybe it's different watching it in L.A.? Maybe? Because, really take the Sharon Tate thing personally. And this felt like,
you know,
Tarantino took it personally and fucking killed those sons of bitches for what they did.
Well, that's interesting you're saying that, because to piggyback on what Phil's saying about, Phil's saying about Inglourious Basterds, is I think there are a lot of people, like, we walked out of the theater and I asked my husband, I said, you know, how much do you know about Sharon Tate and the Manson family murders? And he's like, not a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you don't, and obviously Phil, you do know, but like, I wonder too, in people going to see it and not knowing a lot of that, And not that I feel like you should be rooting or gleeful for anyone's murder, but you're right. It's very easy to for you to kill Nazis and people are like, yeah, go get them. Exactly. And then this happened and I knew that history and not that I was going, oh, yeah, go get them. But like I said, I did not it almost makes me feel weird, but like I didn't feel remorseful, but nobody was cheering.
Oh, no. My theater was full blown cheering at their death. Like they were like, yes. Kill them, kill them, kill them. Like, it was a bloodthirsty audience. It was a little uncomfortable for me, who was not laughing. But, man, right. My theater was,
it was
into it.
It was as... There was... This was a weird film to sort of see in a fairly packed theater. Mine was fairly packed, too, although the theaters here are... We got recliners now, and so it's, right. You know, 200 seats, and you're far apart. It's not quite the same communal experience, but, yeah, I was in a place where I had strangers on my right and left who were reacting very differently. I could see the people in front of me reacting differently. Mm. It was a weird scene, but yeah, being informed of the history and knowing the story of what actually happened, I was like, go get the flamethrower. Why not?
And I didn't feel remorseful about the flamethrower, but that was the kind of scene where it got so it did. Like, it's like Cliff Booth was like, yeah, he punched some people in the face and he threw Bruce Lee around, but he went full blown like, oh, you guys walked into the wrong house and I'm on acid. So like, yes, I'm going to take it all out on you. And like, you're going to, if you live through the, you're going to live to regret it. And so you're like, oh my gosh, like the whole movie isn't not very violent at all. It's got a very, it's very paced. And then all of a sudden it just like, it goes 0 to 60 and you're like, oh, and then it culminates in Sadie, Glutz or Susan Atkins running out and Rick, who has also kind of been a little bit oblivious to anything that Cliff's really been doing or feeling like kind of the whole movie, is like, oh, what the fuck, you know, with his margaritas, and then just goes and gets the flamethrower. But like the way she came out and ran out had this, like, for me, had almost this sort of like Evil Dead feeling, like the screaming and the erratic movement. And he was kind of like, oh, and then just like took care of her
on margaritas. That was probably pretty frightening.
Yeah. Right. It was all very, it got real ridiculous.
I will say my major problem with the scene, and this was also because I had to do all that research I mentioned earlier into the actual murder. Mm-hmm. Since the whole thing is a fairy tale, I honestly take issue with him quoting the dude from the murder.
Mm.
Like the, I am the devil and here to do the devil's work. Like that's what he actually said to them.
Yeah, that is. Yes.
Like, are we actually going full tilt on this or not? Like if we want to be a fairy tale and kind of like almost roast these people for being, I mean, at one point literally roast these people for being who they were, then maybe we shouldn't give them the credit of what they actually said. Like that's the only thing in the movie that really rubs me the wrong way. Like because everything else is just so heightened and just something, this other level than reality. And then that one moment, like, and maybe it was intentional and maybe that's why I feel uncomfortable, was because that one moment is like, oh no, this fucking happened.
Yeah. It pulled you back.
Yeah. It really broke that spell for a minute. And like, cause I was kind of with my audience of like, yeah, fuck these people. And then as soon as he says it, it's like, I do like the response. I thought that was good.
Nah, it was something stupider.
Yeah, like I liked that. And I feel like it was maybe Tarantino's way of like, yeah, he said something horrifying, but it was also just stupid. He was an idiot kid. And like,
just completely taking the piss out of the strength of that.
Yeah, and I just, I feel like that was the one thing in there he didn't need to do. Like that, I agree that taking all the power away from those people in that horrific event is a great idea, but we got it without having to remind us of the horrible things they said too. Because we got it from everything else you've shown us that didn't already kind of happen, but it kind of did. This one 100% did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, maybe that was the point, was to make me go, like, oh, I know this is all fun and games, but it's
I could talk about this movie for hours.
Oh, yeah, you really can. Luckily, I have another podcast on it in, like, 6 months when it hits home video.
The film, perfect. yeah, I can't wait to watch it again. I can't wait to watch it again. And my, if nothing else, I've been kind of, 2018 for me is probably my favorite year of movies since I've been alive. Mm. And 2019 has been a dumpster fire. But in the past 3 weeks, I've seen this. I've seen Crawl. I've seen Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. And I've loved all three of them. Mm. And I feel like this started the 2019 is entering its phoenix stage. It's rising from the ashes for me. And I mean, is there anything else that you guys want to address other than just sort of a wrap up of your general feelings about the movie?
Oh, you know what I'll mention that we have yet to mention? That little girl. How wonderful was she?
She was awesome.
Future star.
Oh my gosh. She was so perfectly placed, and just the watching Leonardo DiCaprio with her while she went into her, like, she morphed into like a 30-year-old like start like woman.
Yeah, been there, done that.
Oh my God, amazing. And I just love, yeah, Leonardo DiCaprio being like, I'm sorry, who are you? What are you? What's happening right now? Like, that scene was magical. I loved her. She was fantastic.
Yeah, and that scene was emblematic, too, of something that I really enjoyed. Tarantino's dialogue is usually so sharp that there's just no fat on it. Like, people don't say, or have long pauses. Mm-hmm. It's just so flashy and showy that, you know, it's just cut straight through it. But there were moments in this film that felt almost improvised when Cliff Booth and Rick are watching his episode of FBI and just sort of commentating over it, which if they don't put that on like DVD extras of those guys just commentating over the film and character, I will be severely disappointed. But that was another example, you know, when he was talking to that girl, she was very polished and her dialogue was very sharp, and he's just sort of stuttering and stammering and coughing and it when you're used to Tarantino's rhythms with his dialogue, this movie took a completely different strategy.
And yes.
I loved it. Brian, anything from you that you want to put a bow on?
I'm not really sure how much I have to put a bow on it right now, because I'm still like...
Let's leave the box open.
Yeah, like I need to see it another time, and I know I won't have time to see it in theaters, which is a bummer, because that's, in my opinion, really the only great way to watch a Tarantino movie is in theaters. Like, he makes sure of that.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
So I'm going to have to rent it at some point, or I'll probably just buy it when it comes out, and then I'll probably be able to make up my mind, but... I think overall, I still kind of sit where I did when I came home from the movie, which is weird for having seen it over a week ago, which was like, I don't think it's his best movie ever made. I probably put it towards the top, but not in the top. But I do think it's the most he's ever had to sit. And I think for that, it merits almost all the acclaim that it's gotten so far. Like there's something to be said about like Tarantino and how he just kind of makes these really fun movies with a point, and you get the point from frame one, and it doesn't really change throughout, but it still drives that message home constantly. Mm-hmm. And this one was just super layered. Like there was tons of different things that he was saying, and there's a love letter to this, that, and the other, and it had so many moving parts, and it is almost 3 hours long, so that I really wrap my head around it, and to give it like that final stamp of approval or disapproval, I got to go another time. I have no idea.
I've never wanted to dig into one of his films like I will dig into this one when I have it in my home.
And see, I thought that about Hateful Eight. Like, I thought Hateful Eight when I walked out of it. I'm like, oh, there was a ton in that movie, and it all took place in one location, and I can't wait to go home and really dive into it. And I brought it home, and I watched it. I'm like, nope, feel the same way. I still really like it, but I don't think I missed much. Whereas this one, I'm like, oh, what did I miss? And I know I missed something.
Oh, sure. Yeah, and I feel like this is the type of movie that there's going to be a fluidity to your feelings about it, just as you change as a person, as mm-hmm. you get older. I mean, it's just, it's such a rich, rich film, and a very rewarding film to discuss and to think about. And I will have to see Jackie Brown again. I haven't seen it in a while. That mm-hmm. has been my that's been the top of the mountain for me as far as Tarantino movies go.
Mm-hmm.
But wow, this one surprised me, and it's under my skin, in a way that none of Tarantino's movies have ever sort of achieved.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely has stuck with me a lot longer than like, say, like Inglourious Basterds, which I walked out of going, that was fucking awesome. Can't wait to see it again because it was so awesome. This one, you kind of walk away going like, oh man, that has wormed its way into my brain.
Yep. Mm-hmm. I need more.
Like, I think the last movie I had that sort of like, I need to figure out more about it reaction to was The Babadook, which is a totally different movie. But like, that was the last time I'm like, what the fuck is all going on in this movie? I need to figure out everything. And now it's, I still think, probably the best horror movie of the past 10 years, if not longer. So this one, maybe it will grow to that, because I didn't think that when I first saw Babadook, but on like the 50th viewing, I'm like, nope, I'm wrong. It was the best. It's definitely the best.
Yeah. for me, it was Annihilation.
Oh, Annihilation was so good.
Yeah, the Babadook is up there too. But yeah, I love these films that just, they get into your marrow.
Yeah.
And you find yourself thinking about them just random parts of the day. And that's where I stand on this one. I don't buy movies as much as I used to, but this one's going to be on my shelf. Aaron, any last thoughts?
No, I think you guys pretty much summed it up. And, you know, I spent, same thing. It usually takes me a couple days. I just saw it on Monday. So takes me a couple days to just kind of move through it. Just trying to, like I'm even still like, about it. And I think I need to like, not in a bad way, but just like, I don't have all my words about it because
mm-hmm.
there are so many layers. And the way he interwove the two stories, I thought was just really fascinating. Yeah, I love stuff like that. So I would definitely recommend it, and I will probably also see it again to just, pay more attention to all of the details, because there were a lot of really excellent, like, there's a lot of attention to detail in this movie, too.
Yeah.
Holy shit. I'm so sorry to do this to you, and I know I hate all guests who do it to me. Not that I hate them, you know what I mean? But I forgot something that had to be mentioned, and it's the best line in the entire movie. And it's the, and here it is, folks, the moment you've all been waiting for. That one line set the tone for 30 minutes of movie better than anything I've ever seen. It was, and it's a narration line. Like, it's not even something somebody says. That was so amazingly well done. I'm still trying to figure out how the hell he pulled it off.
Yeah. I don't know. There's just so much to this film, and we could talk about it for hours, but I think we've got a good first draft.
If I didn't mention that one part, I'd feel horrible. So I'm glad horrible. I remember.
Well, I'm sure I'm going to lay down to go to sleep tonight and remember something that I forgot, but that's what the future is for. So yeah, I think all three of us, if you haven't gotten it yet, we are enraptured with this film, fascinated by this film. I can't wait to talk to everyone about it. I'm going to be that annoying guy. Have you seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood yet?
We'll have to figure out a way to have you on After the Hype when we eventually cover it.
Oh, I'd love to. So yeah, I think that's a good time to depart. I'd like to thank my guests, Brian Dressel, Aaron McCabe. I am Phil Rockwell. Go see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's delicious. Thanks for joining me, guys.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Have a wonderful night.
This episode is a production of the Front Row Network, a proud Community Voices member of National Public Radio, Illinois. For more information and to see the full slate of Front Row Network shows, you can visit frnpod.com or nprillinois.org.